Greeting gallery is named after a Wiat word meaning way up, looking back. And I think it is most appropriate that we have George Blake's retrospective here today to be able to do that, to look back on all of his work and all that he's done. I want to say thank you to Julie Alderson, professor, art history professor who curated this show, and to the Art 356 students who acted as exhibition preparators and put the display together, and the reception here as well. I'm going to invite Adrienne Colgrove-Ramon up to say a few words. She is the coordinator for the Native American Center for Academic Excellence, better known as ITEC, for all of you. And then after, George is going to take the microphone and go for a walk through the gallery and talk about his work, and we'll cut some cake and you can enjoy the reception as well. So welcome, everyone.
Well, welcome, and this is, I worked for Humboldt State for going on 20 years now, and I've introduced a lot of people. I've introduced Billy Mills, I've introduced great speakers and collaborators from across the nation, and I can't think of one that I've been more nervous to introduce and more excited to introduce than my cousin Porty. I've been thinking about this all week, and it touches home, and it's such a beautiful thing to see him receive the honorary doctorate the other night and to see all the family down here. I've seen more family at the campus in the last 2 weeks with Kishan getting appointed, moving up in her appointment as professor here, and then as Porty receiving this degree. And it's just such an honor, and it's so beautiful to see our people here and enjoying the campus and all these facilities that were made for us. So I truly appreciate that. But Porty, George Blake, I guess, that's a professional name. Just like I'm Adrian, but I'm really going to be. So. But Porty, you know, has been such an inspiration to many of us in our family, in our community, and across the nation and Indian country. What is so amazing about his work is that it comes from a place, you know, from home. And a lot of his work has been inspired by his taking the time and effort to talk to our elders and to learn from them and spend time with them. I remember as a young child, and Porty was very close to my grandmother, and his mother and my grandmother were sisters. And so he spent a lot of time with our family, but what I mostly remember is Porty having his own family, a very large family, and spending so much time with us and spending time with the old people and my grandma in particular, and coming over and never hesitating, you know, to offer help or assistance and just spending that quality time to learn and then to share and always bring in something, you know, for all of us. He never missed any of our graduations. He never missed any of our celebrations. He's also a spiritual man, so he also helped us during times of grief when we have lost people in our family. And he utilized all this knowledge that he received throughout his life to help everyone. He helps us in spiritual way, he helps us in physical way if we need it, and mostly what he offered to many of us was inspiration. I'll never forget when I graduated from high school. I actually received this bracelet, and he asked about the other night. I still have it. I graduated from high school, and Porty gave me this, and he said, he put a watch on the side, and he said, you know why I'm giving you this, right? The watch is on the side so that you can sit in those boring meetings and you can look down without them knowing that you're trying to check the time. So you already pictured me, you know, doing these professional meetings. And I always remember when I received my card, I still have it, from graduation, and he said, here's to Honeybee, you'll be the next president of the United States. You know, he always was looking at other people and trying to inspire us. I'm sure my story is just one of, you know, few that I'm sure everyone has a story like that. I know we all feel it in our heart, this wonderful man, you know, that was before us. So to see him receive this honor for the work that he's done and watch him go across the world with his art and to share those stories with us and to have our community honor him is really a blessing. For that, I just want to say, Porty, I'm so, so very proud and honored. I wish my father were here to see this because he would be so, so proud. And I know he's here in some way. And our grandma and my aunt as well. But anyway, what an honor. And I thank you all for coming tonight. I hope you enjoy this wonderful man and his work.
Hello. You hear me? Good. There it is. Well, I got to make a little correction here. That was college graduation. But there's a lot to it because, you know, she got married and her husband was going to school and she graduated off from when you graduate, you know. She was middle year or something. So anyway, busy helping her husband graduate. And then they never was no hoopla about her graduation. It was, you know, so I remember going to the home for her husband's graduation and everything. And then her dad called me up. He said, I want you to make these bracelets for them, you know, for graduation and for her husband. I was walking out the door. He says, make one for Honeybee too. So I did. And then years later, the mom said, you know, I want to tell you something. She says, my daughter has never been an emotional person. And she thought everybody forgot about her graduation, you know, but Willie gave her that watch, you know, with the bracelet, and she cried. Let's go on and do this stuff here. Okay, there's not chronological from the oldest to the newest, not everything. So I'm just going to walk through here and talk about this stuff, okay? This is one of the dancers in the white deerskin dance is a hook man. And these hooks are made out of sea lion tusk. I don't think that anybody ever made one like they did a long time ago anymore. I've tried a couple of times, it don't work. This also was a weaving thing that I've seen where anthropologists talks about our people, where this was a woven piece that they wore on the back for the dances. And we never met wolf clothing or anything. That's the only thing we wove. I think there was a somewhat of a mat made, you know, but it wasn't like weaving like this, but it was strange how the people saw that. We didn't do that. I guess I'm talking about the same. I did. So anyway, this is a U-wood piece. I've been in my life ever since, I don't know, 71 or something, I started making the thing, but it just didn't seem to work. And I didn't allow enough wood to make this basket cap the way it sat on it. And I got connected with a world famous guy who died about 3 years ago. He hired somebody to bring him to see me in his 90s. I was just thinking about what a compliment that was. He was a world-renowned record holder in archery, and he had a world-renowned collection that was so extraordinary that pressure came down for him to leave it in the United States when he was going to leave it in England. But anyway, so he would bring me things like he bought this basket in an auction in Seattle, and it was a hoopla basket. You can see there's burn marks on the inside where somebody used it. I was thinking maybe went to the high country, and that basket was a cap, and eventually they had a cook, and they just took it off and cooked in it. Maybe, I don't know. But anyway, so this doctor got that for me, and I'm really sorry I didn't bring a bow and maybe a quiver and all that stuff. I made some of that stuff that went up in senators, congressmen, one governor, you know, gifts to them, but I should have brought a bow and arrow because when I started making bows, no one was making them anywhere in hoopla people, and I had to research and find all this knowledge to that, but it'll take a while to talk about that now. So anyway, there's a hook man. Okay, this guy here, funny, you know, there was a humor book that came out, and I made this thing years before the humor book came out, and I won't tell you what the things were rejected, but when they opened this show in San Francisco, they planned it, and I showed up with some things, and they rejected two pieces that I brought out. Didn't want this one, didn't want that one, you know, and one of the things was a cigar store white man. I was going to make him 6 feet tall, and she said, no, we're not going to do that, you know, and so I said, well, I can give him a detachable head, because they were going to move, and, you know, travel for 3.5 years, but, you know, so she said, no, and the other one I won't tell you about, because it's a little raw. It's in a drawer in my studio, my daughters hate it, but, you know, over the ages, the masters, old masters, they did all these torso things, and that's what I'll say about it. Okay, but anyway, so this was laying around, and I was doing ceramics up there, and it was a little bit small. I should have made it really big, the Washington Redskins, you know, I watched when they played San Francisco, and the Raiders beat them. They played the Washington Redskins, and they beat them. I suppose I can't check for this, but you know, when that happened, I was watching a football game before the season was down to the playoffs. It was like a wild card, and I sat down to watch television, and a message came to me, said that, hi. Well, professor, I had CR back in the 60s, I think, started. Floyd Pettinga. Anyway, but you know that, so this message came to me every time I sat down to watch football, and you know, I knew who was going to win, and then went all the way through and won the Super Bowl. In fact, her mom, I used to visit her almost every day, her grandma, you know, and so, you know, she knew that I knew all the way through. So next season came, and right away she wanted to know who's going to win this year, you know. I picked the 49ers, but that didn't happen. It didn't come to me. But anyway, the piece, you know, just recently got into lots of controversy. You know, this got into that show, and it that traveled the United States for 3.5 years, and it ended in New York. And all the time that I've had exhibits and things travel or wherever shows open, they never used my piece to put on the invitation, ever. I've never been in one that did that. But when it was going to go to New York, the people in the Smithsonian in New York called me and asked if they could drill that big piece I had in that one. It's in the Smithsonian right now. But it was a big redwood piece. And they called me and asked if they could drill a bottom so when the people walked into the show, it would tower over them. So I said, okay. And then they called from the Smithsonian in D.C. about buying this piece. But they didn't want to pay what I wanted for it, so stay with me. Okay, that was before all the controversy on the Redskins, but this is called the D.C. Rednecks. I said, new image, you know, and I wrote it all up in the book about the, you know, the moral majority and the whole thing. Let's go on to something else. Okay, let's go over here. So this whole jewelry really took off from me. I did a piece in jewelry when I was at the university, and it was just a friend teaching a class, and it was like an entertainment class for students, so I took that. You know, I made a ring, and I came home, and I started, you know, wanted to do something else, and I was meant to museum, and so I'm making my wife an earring for Christmas or something, you know, and it just started to take off. But in, I think from the time I started making bracelets to about 6 months, I got a Smithsonian contract for bracelets. And it was like a $10,000 order. And I'm kicking myself yet. I never even asked for another contract. I just went on. But anyway, jewelry has really exploded for me. And I've been blessed to do some great stuff, you know, with the basket design and from this area where we live. A lot of these things have a story to them. But anyway, these two pieces, these figures that are standing in there, they started before I went to school. You know, so they just kind of left undone too. But my daughter had to have those cherry bushes. She wants those. And so anyway, they were covered. It's in the studio. From the moths and whatever else is on it, spiders. But anyway, so we'll move on to something else. So over here is a piece of Ewood, and it was 1978. We were fishing down on the mouth of the Klamath River, and we were camping under my dad's property down there on the glen. And I thought it was a spider, but it wasn't. anyway, we were camping, and we had a campfire down there. My dad goes down under the, you know, on the riverside, and he comes marching up, you know, and he was older, you know, but he come marching up with his log on his shoulder, and he dropped it right in front of me, and he says, "I thought you could carve something out of this." I thought, "Nah, what am I doing? This here? You know, we're fishing, and I thought, well," I kept looking at it. I thought, "Well, maybe." Later, I got a chainsaw and cut the thing in half. I thought then I would make a set of these with two ladies, you know, like this, because, you know, the girls, they dance and dances at home all the time, and it could be a nice piece. So when I got it ready, and I told my aunt, it was Honeybee's grandma, I said, "Auntie," I said, she had lots of baskets, "so I'm going to buy a basket from you, and I'm going to cut it in half, and I'm going to make two of these." She said, "No, I got one the dog chewed on, you use that one." So I only got one, lost the other piece. But it, you know, then I put it in the museum in Hoopon. I put a good price on it for insurance. And my daughter seen me one time. She said, "Failing," says, "what are you going to do, sell that thing?" They insured it for this much. She said, "Well, you know, I guess I'll buy it then," she said. And she's working for a course up there. But then, anyway, I said, "Well, my brother wants to sell me that jet boat in his yard for $4,500. She said, "Okay." So she bought the jet boat for me, and that's hers. Okay, this is almost one of the newer pieces right here. It's I kept it from even going to a show because I figured, you know, I didn't know the show was coming at that time, but, you know, it's a raku piece, and I've played with the basket design enough to start doing spiraling through in column and jewelry also, and I started doing like graphics of river design, you know, changed it around me, so it flows, you know, and this one. It somewhere in the raku process, the design started to fade on me. It's on the fading river butterfly. Okay, so anyway, we'll go over here. Okay, this is a piece that must have been 79. I start to finish this one in another couple, but had some hard times at the university. I was at the University of California going to school, which I finished there, but we had a baby that lived 30 days, a boy. And that, you know, it's really, it makes you wonder why these things happen, but I had a dream fishing again. I was up on the Klamath River fishing, and the dream told me to name him after an angel. I called him Ton Gabriel. I have a grandson sitting back there. His name is Ton Gabriel, too, now. His dad wanted to name him that. I didn't say no, but, you know, anyway, it's a second Ton. But Ton is a mythical spirit in Hoopoe that takes care of the deer. And Gabriel's archangel. But anyway, when we named him, we had two deer, fawns, that came into our lives at just at the same time, watching over them deer, you know, and somebody grabbed one and hauled it in the mountains and turned it loose, and the other one stayed with us until it died. But it was so amazing to have this fawn in the house, because Faylene had a studio back where I was doing jewelry, and she said she'd be in there. All of a sudden, she'd feel, and that thing is looking right at her. And I find the same thing. I'll be doing jewelry. All of a sudden, I stop, and he's right here with his face right at me. I could just feel him, and you could actually feel that thing. You know, it's amazing how that spirit in them works that way, I guess. You know, several times I felt that thing, and she felt it all the time like that. It was amazing. But anyway, the spirit takes care of the deer, Tom. Anyway, so let's go over here. Again, this is an old guy here. I don't know. I don't remember where one. I was going to a show in L.A., and underneath the year was carved way years ago, and I changed it to a recent one. Changed it in, but showed no place anyway. But it didn't get sold anyway, even though one was sold to the Gene Autry. It didn't either. I sold to a lady who wrote a book with my stuff in it, and then she eventually gave it to Gene Autry. It was accepted, and it's going on a show this month, I think, down there in L.A. But anyway, I've been doing them a while, and I just stopped. I got one more laying at the house. We're going to have two here, but I lost one of the rhinestones, and the rhinestone boot was, I called it dude boot because it had a zipper on the side. But anyway, then the knife here is, I was doing furniture workshops in Hoopoe for 5 years. We did this greenwood furniture where you use a pole lathe, you know, and just the chips just flying all over. It was nice, you know, we did furniture and everything for those years. And then, but the guy that came over, the second guy came over, and he came 5 years. But anyway, the first year he came, he needed a knife, he came back and he started making knives. And I went over to see him, and then I started making knives with him. And so maybe the second or third time I went over to make knives, I made this knife. By that time, he has all the research in it. He's got the best steel he can use without being stainless steel. It's 1% carbon. But he had these camel bones that they use. They sell for making really fine handles, you know. And I think they use giraffe now, too. It's a little hard to get, they said. But anyway, so I made the sturgeon back design on this knife. But I designed it so it would kind of spiral in my hand really good working with deer, you know, and skinning deer, because I did a major research on deer and how to take the sinew out, all that. Because everybody hunts, and for all my time in my early life, that people cut the legs off and throw them in the rig, you know. And but you know, that's where the main deer sinew is, right up through the legs, you know. So I did a whole research, did discs on them, how to do that now. But anyway, Cherico bought this one from me, and I gave her the other one I had. And so there was my knife, and I had to borrow it because my nephew, he's not here tonight, but anyway, he got graduated from CR. He helped make that boat that's at Humboldt here, and he did that because he was in the eighth grade, seventh grade, and he got kicked out of school, and I made him come along and help me work with him, the college students finished the boat, you know. And so, but you know, just a little touch about him, you know, he graduated just this last June, and in the course of getting close to graduation, he came down to my studio, and he's sitting there down in the mouth, and I said, "What's the matter, Cotep?" He said, "I'm going to deal with this B." For 2 years, he got straight A's, and then he got a B plus. He didn't like that. But, you know, he even also got the first standing ovation in Hoopoe that I ever heard of or saw, you know, in Hoopoe when he spoke about his experience, you know, and 20 years going in and out of prison, then all of a sudden his life changes, and there he is, you know, graduated, ready to come to Humboldt here pretty quick. But anyway, so it's exciting. So I had to borrow this knife, you know, to make, because my kids asked Cotep, said, "What do you want for graduation?" "I only want a knife by Porter Blake," you know. So I had some that I had to put together, and I started putting it together, and then he'd ask, "Is he making my knife?" is he working on my knife? He said, well, do you think he can do it in 2 days? But I had it. I got it ready, you know, and it's there's other people want them from that time, but I can't fulfill all the orders. But anyway, so I had to borrow this one from Cherico to see how I put the design on, and I got it in my hand, and it felt so good in my hand. It was just made for me. I said, what did I sell this for? I'm going to make another one for myself. Okay, well, there's another raku piece here. There's not a whole lot to talk about. They're designed from what was a tobacco pouch that would, you know, fit in your hand like a basket with a woven lid. In fact, there's two guys come from Reno, Redding, the thing we had last night, and they brought me a basket. It was a wind tune basket from over there. It was really nice. But anyway, this is the way that they tied this thing together, and also this one here is depicted from the leather tops on baskets, too. And I didn't know about this until I was running our museum in Hoopaw, and I found a basket about this size. It just fit in the palm of your hand, and then it had leather attachment to it. And that was also a tobacco pouch. And so I've taken those to spiritual, sculptural sizes, you know. And before I go to that one, I'll tell you about this one here. There's a big left hand on the side of this thing when you look at it. And before I came back from, I finished UC Davis, and I was working in Cement Finishers Union down there. And my son came down to stay with us in Box. And so he came down, and he started getting lots of notoriety in Box. And, it just took off for him, willing to go on the gloves and everything. And then we helped set up a new gym down there in the west part of Sacramento. And he got really good at it. In fact, he beat a guy in the amateurs by the name of Tony Lopez, who got so disgusted he was a three-generation boxer, and he quit boxing when Robert beat him. And when Robert came back to the reservation, that guy started boxing. He came back to the same gym we were at. Then he went on back with his dad, and he became a world champion. I watched him on television, because I'd go and see, I saw him when he won, I saw when he lost, and I saw when he won again. It was exciting. And at that time, there was a guy that came into the gym named Loretto Guerrero, and he was new. He wasn't twin brother, but they were both high school boys. They started boxing, and the brother didn't like it, but Loretto loved it. And not long after that, he became a world champion. And I used to run a museum, and I'd find reasons to go to Sacramento on my way to the gym, and then go on over to Berkeley, get the stuff, move back and forth to our museum. But, you know, I said, I'll never forget. I walked in there one time. They were sparring session just coming over, and he was wringing wet from head to toe, and he saw me standing in the corner, turned around, and he leaped almost over the ropes and just wrapped me up like that, and it just dripping wet. And I said, I'll take this hug to my grave. It was so exciting. Okay, let's go over here. So anyway, about this left hand on there, and when I was here in Hoopaw training boxers, and I was working on ceramics, and I said, you know, at the University of California, there was a class George Longfish ran, and there was a painter in the Southwest that painted when the earliest people came, and they made a painter out of him so they could show them what things were like before people came, the non-Indian people. So he was called Big Left Hand, yeah, because he had a big left hand. So I said, well, if you box, man, if you ain't got a big left hand, you ain't going no place either. So that's how that happened. Plus, I got my last knockout. I got a knockout in Eureka one time with left hand. Anyway, so this is these boats were just prepared for the dance in Wichpec. And it's a spiritual work in life, you know, that happens up on the river up there, these ceremonies that are the white deerskin dance. And I one time I hit a low spot in my, I don't know what years that was. I went out to the deerskin dance. The kids brought the camera, and it was at Hostler Creek where they dance, and then little toward the evening, just about dark, they'll all load up in the boats and they'll go down the river, and they dance down. And so when that happened, just before, they were dancing up here, and I took a camera and I run down, and I was looking at those boats in the river there. And I saw that the one boat was laying there. I said, Haynes, Dewey George made that boat, and Haynes Moore made that boat, and they made all five of the rest of them. And I thought, I might not be getting rich and famous as an artist, but I must be doing something for my people. But years went by, and I made these boats for those guys to dance in up in Wichpec. And that's my dad's people, but it was more story to it than that. I don't really do the ceremonies that much with them. You know, I've always supported them. And then, so my cousins, like Honeybee's dad and his brother, they do major parts of the dance. And so when we went down there to help them with the dance, they borrowed our boats. There was a dispute over that, but they did borrow the boats that I made for them. And they brought them down, and then they danced. And standing right at the below the bridge there against the rock hillside there, they were dancing the deerskin dance, and they pass out this angelica root for the guys to pray, you know. And there's certain ways they pray on the river there, you know. And the one guy that knew I wasn't, you know, dance people, but say to speak like my cousins were, but he came up and he just kind of gave a piece of root behind him like that, put it in my hand. He didn't want everybody on the bridge to see he was giving me that. But I went to the river. I mean, I went from we're off at the edge of the river, and I went up and where the fire was, because it was an honor to pray with them on their fire. So I scraped the roots out and I asked for them to have their own wood and to have their own boats. I didn't even know they had wood, but I guess during the Settlement Act, they did get some wood. And so then it just kind of happened where they got wood, and I had wrote a grant to get some to make a couple of boats, and I couldn't find wood. And these guys needed the wood off the hill, but they didn't have money to move them. And there was two Yurok councilmen right there with them, and they knew that I had this money in the Seventh Generation Fund. I took it away from the Humble Larry Foundation, so I wouldn't lose it until I found the wood. Anyway, one of the councilmen says, "Let's just take his wood. I mean, let's just take his money, you know, and log with him." But I gave them the money to move the boats and the logs into Hoopaw, and that's where these were made, you know. And then I was the one doing the boat making. And the last day, it was Phil B. Hill standing there back there. And he was burning them and rubbing them off with pictures of him and us. Finished that last day fixing these boats for the dance. And they danced. And so this was just the maiden voyage day, you know. And I made it's a woodcut, you know. And so I did another one in England. It was a single boat with these two figures in it. And there was fishing. A guy was spearing. I heard that this old man was trying to spear sturgeon like that, and the younger guy said, he went up to see the guy up at Stawin, and the old man said, "Let's go fish," and he got in there. He said, but he was telling me about the boat. Every time that old man stuck that paddle in the water, it looked like the boat just jumped like that every time he put that paddle. He was an old man. I saw him near 100, you know, but anyway, my dad sent us to him and made sure we shook hands with that old man. But anyway, so they got up to the other end of that bar, and then the old man got up in the front, and he said, "Now you paddle." They went out into the riffle there, you go out in the middle, and that's where the old man threw, and he missed the sturgeon out there. So that's how I happened to make that piece, you know. I got home and sold it as soon as I got to a show. But I mean, I don't know how many more I can make out of the print. The woodcut is not lasting. I'm going to get better wood next time. There's another canoe back here, but it's just been around a long time. I keep forgetting about holding this thing in my face. If you can't hear me, holler. Anyway, it's got all this. The nice lady in there with Debbie McConnell made a cap, and Kathy Sherman made that before she left, that baby basket. And but it's just with like a family piece. But I do have these miniatures. I cut about four. I got three of them at home that are 9 feet long, and you know, I'm hoping to make figures for them. But you know, I have to have fun with it, you know, because the old man, Glenn Moore, was married to my aunt, a great aunt, and. Anyway, he knew his grandpa had 10 wives. I thought, that'd be a nice subject, man. I could have these ladies just leaning out all over this boat, you know, just going to the dance, and I could have some fun with that subject. I think I'm going to do it. So, but anyway, this is an elk antler purse and hair sticks. I was supposed to prepare some, and I didn't, so I borrowed one from my daughter and from her daughter-in-law and throw them in here. And then I started making purses back in 60s, this elk antler purses, they were a money carrier. Money was an Italian shell among the Northern California people here. And I was fascinated, the one I saw in Smith River. They said it was alive. That the people that owned it had to put some, I think, gopher fur every so often in the thing. So they brought it for us to pray for it at the Shaker Church, and that's where I saw it. But anyway, it was beautiful, and I'd never seen one in Hoopaw ever, because all that stuff was picked up and put in museums. We're all across the world, you know, all over these big museums. There was a lot of them in Berkeley. I'd borrow them for our museum when I got our museum. And I started studying them. I kept making bunches, but I make them all the time. And they're pretty nice. In fact, the first 20 years it took to sell one for over $200, $230, I think, in the show over here at NCIDC show. Another 20 years, I sold one down in Gene Autry last year for $2,500. But the guy that was going to buy it said, I come over here every year from Nevada, and I buy for the museum. So they told me when I got here, said, if you buy anything this year, you buy that purse for us. So he says, I'm right here asking you, because it got a second place, and we didn't even stick around for the reception. We just went off and ate. I thought he should have got a first. But anyway, so you know, he came in the next day. He wanted to buy this piece, and he says, well, I want to know how much I can get this for, the best price I can get for it. I said, well, I sold one for the clinic over there for $22, and then a month later, I sold one $22 over at Hoopa. I said, $25 ain't bad. So he wrote out a check, but then he ran to the show we just had last week in San Francisco, and he told a professor I know there, I said, do you know George Blake? He said, yeah. He says, man, he drives a hard bargain. So this is cast aluminum at Humboldt State here. And it's a form of casting that's really fast. You can carve, and that's what I made the torso piece out of, we talked earlier. But anyway, this piece, to cast, do this casting in aluminum, is you carve it directly into styrofoam, and then you put a gate on it someplace, which is someplace with a metal, molten metal pours in, and maybe a place where the gas can escape out of it, you know, so it, you know, that's the way it's done. And so I did this one, and this is Indian time, no numbers, you know, and people always late on whatever they're doing, it's Indian time. And then someone told me recently, said, you know, that's not really right. He said, Indians always took care of time, right? It's when the acorns fall, you have a certain time to pick up them acorns, because in this next month, in November, that's the time you leave them alone for angels. And the deer, you know, at this time of year, they're hunting, but pretty soon the deer bucks will get stinking, you don't want to kill them then. It's right into almost the rut. And same thing with all the berries, at a certain time it's there. I knew an old man that they asked him when his birthday was. He said, when the salmon berries get ripe. So, you know, you had to take care of things on time. So, you know, maybe not the clicking, ticking clock, but, you know, the time thing. Anyway, let's move on here. I've been talking all night. Another tobacco pouch here. These are new things. I'm doing them over at Fire Arts. I'm going to try to get my studio back going again in Hoopa. And then daughter-in-law's going to start making. I didn't bring any cups and put them in here, but I got cups going out there. And I did the same thing about they were going to put a sign over where the jewelry is because I sell things down at Fire Natural Selection on the plaza. And none of these things are on sale in here. They're, you know, collection of the artist. But anyway, and most of, like, this is my daughter, Faelene's, another tobacco pouch. I gave her that one day. She said, you know how long I've been lusting for that thing. So, okay, there's another piece that I keep referencing back to Honeybee's grandma, which, you know, I lived with them, I think, the last 2 years of high school, you know, and so, you know, I really cherished what she said when she told me this. It wasn't finished, but she was a basket maker. I don't think she made baby baskets, but she made other kinds of baskets all the time. When I brought this out and showed her, she looked at it and she said, this is a masterpiece. And I don't know about that, but anyway, I had it in New York in Manhattan one time, and there was an older lady that came up to me with it. She just kind of milled around in the place all evening until the crowd cleared off, and then she came up and said, you know, she said, I've been here all my life, and I've seen a lot of sculpture, and I've never seen anything like this that has an effect to me that I want to just pick it up and hold it. But anyway, I passed that piece right there, but over here, we're going to look at these guys here. When I was, I don't know when it was, but you know, I went through a divorce, and it was kind of impacting my life. I needed to do something. I ran back and forth to Europe, and I ran up with somebody who was, you know, a printer, and then I had this friend in Susanville who I went out and poured the slab for her studio back in the 80s, and that's the last time I was out there. And anyway, in this time where I was in a low place, she said, well, you know, you have an open studio anytime you want. And pretty soon I was buzzing to Susanville. You know, I was running back and forth over, learning how to print. And she was, you know, a big lady, you know. I mean, she's just big, taller than me, you know. Anyway, so she started telling me how to print, and I well, first I was going to do woodcutting. I didn't even know. And she said, I asked her, well, how big is your press? She said, 30 by 40. I came with a piece of wood, 30 by 40. What did you bring that for? But I used a Dremel tool, and I cut it real fast, and it didn't really work for print, to put prints off them, but it had all this nice color on it, and I just framed it and gave it to Cherry Coo, and she's got it hanging in her house. So, but anyway, so time went on, and I began to learn more about printmaking just from scratch. And I wanted to get these lines going, and this is not like these two here, but I wanted to get the lines that come up and down. So I made a piece, and I put lines in it. The lines weren't just accurate to what I wanted. And I saw this corrugated piece of cardboard there, and I thought, I'll use that. I cut the design up, and when you put the wet paper on it, it even drops the corrugation a little more inside, so the lines came out just brilliant in this piece. I made 10 of them. And I came back to Susanville. I said, Gene, you know what? I sold that piece to the clinic over here, you know, and that was a buzzword she was using. It has to be archival, got to be framed up, and it's archival. And I said, I told Jerry, it's archival. And he said, we'll buy that. So $500. I said, I made 9, 10 of them, and I said, I sold one for $500. She said, you're printing art, not money. She was always jealous too. But anyway, she set this thing up for us to go down to Santa Fe. There used to be a print-a-thon down there. And people would come and do the monotypes. And then as they'd come and lay the ink down on the plates, you know, and then people would come and help you print. And so I went down and did that, and I did about 20 prints, 22 prints, in fact. And so the next time, when the opening was coming for all these people to have a big opening down, I said, well, I'm not going to the opening all the way down. The guy called me up. Is he coming down for the opening? I said, I don't go to the openings all the time. I never sell anything anytime in the openings. But he said, I thought if you came down, he says, I'd put you in a bigger press. Then I loaded everything up in my four-wheel drive and my head for New Mexico. So there was a lady that he worked with, and they both worked, kind of grew up together in printmaking, you know. And then she got a job in New York printing, you know. And then so her parents wanted her around, so they had some good acreage above Santa Fe, and they built this nice, big, beautiful studio and almost a brand new press, but they got a second hand. So I was probably the first guy who went in there, worked in there. And so this Navajo guy put me in there, and we worked. And then I was down there earlier before it was time for the opening, and so I had to do something. And Cherico, before I left, I took pictures of she had a set of twins. And it excited me when she had twins, because I used to watch twins. You know, I watched these and their reaction to one another. And the one that I always remember so much is this guy lived down on the river, Klamath River, about halfway down to Johnson's, down past Martin's Ferry. And he had a brother, Indian guy, and he had a brother in Redding. But every first of the month, he'd come and spend 1 week with his brother down there. And I watched him, you know. And one would be sitting on the other side of the room, and one sitting on this side of the room, they're both sitting there reading. Don't say nothing, but they're sitting there. You know, they had to communicate like that. But anyway, so, you know, I was excited when my daughter had these twins, you know. And one day I walked in, and she came up from Hoopa. She was down, and she came to Hoopa from, she was on the coast here when she had them, and they're real new. And I came from the studio, came up and walked in, and she had a pillow on her lap, and she had one on each tit. Almost made me cry. So anyway, I was in Santa Fe, you know, and I wanted to see, you know, and I wanted to do something with that, you know. And so I didn't know how to do. I didn't know. Nobody's telling me what to do, you know. So, you know, and I was in Harry Fonseca's house before he died. You know, he went off to do something, and he left me in his place in Santa Fe. So I was running around there, back and forth to art stores and everything. And I got some acetate, you know, not plexiglass, but it had the thick stuff that's, you know, limber. And so I got that thing, and I started carving this. And I carved each one of these guys, you know, scratching it with the X-Acto knife, you know. So I made both of these with the X-Acto knife in a couple of days. And then that guy knew, I showed him what I wanted to do. And so we put, I think it was rice paper or something, we put them out. And I don't remember how or why, if it's that thick or not, but it went over and didn't, I don't see the color coming through, but I colored these all, and it worked. I made four sets of those. And then I gave her one when I came back. Had it all framed, and I saved the best one for myself. Her house burned down and lost those, and so then I wound up giving her these. I pulled them out of her house the other day. Thanks, Cherry. Anyway, so let's move on down through here. I think we're about getting close to the end here now. This old ugly guy here, you know, I was telling Julie the other day, well, it must be kind of like self-portrait. I guess I spent 2 years in France. I run in and out of Paris all the time. I was only 60 miles out of Paris, you know. And said they talked about in France. They said, you know, how do you keep him on a farm when he's been to Paris? You know, that's a, how can you keep him on a reservation when he's been to Paris? this is a beret from England too. I brought that over, kind of funky one now. But I had a jump wings that paratroopers wear in France, and then a guy stole it from me. And this here, it's got the Eiffel Tower. I got those at the same time, brought them back with me, stole them, and they brought this back with lots of the other pieces. But so anyway, I'm gonna get another one of these days. So, but that's that, and it's like rawhide, elk rawhide, and stretched over a carving. It's that the same guy that guy made. So anyway, this is another. It just kind of spells out what you see in a sense. But really, the antler piece. I was demonstrating in the Museum of the American Indian when they had a museum over by Harlem. They now have this museum over right down where the towers went down, but you know it didn't affect the towers. But anyway, I was out there demonstrating for 2 days in the Museum of the American Indian in over by Harlem, and every hour they tell me go take a walk, and there was three stories that you know was displayed of Indian things. And I heard years ago that they had so much stuff out there that the water was rain dripping on it and just ruining some of this stuff. Okay, but anyway. They told me that the things that they have on display in these three floors in that museum constitutes 10%, no, 15% of the collection. You don't imagine how much stuff they got from Indian country out there. But anyway, since then, it has come under the blanket of the Smithsonian, and they have agreements with them to keep the bulk of it in New York, and they trade off around wherever the Smithsonian does stuff. So anyway, one day I was walking up through one of the stories in there, and I saw this antler piece. It was about this long, and the leather attachment was probably this long, so it was hanging from the wall about like this. And I ran over to look at it like that, and it's just picked up in Hoopla, 1900. Since then, man, I've been making lots of them. I don't make the big ones either. I could, but I haven't lately. I made a few. Okay, so there's another piece over here back in probably the 80s. I was doing this. It's a sturgeonback design. Somehow the firing didn't work out, and the bottom blew off, and I just kind of left it around until finally Faye-Ling just had to have that, you know, so I gave it to her. And it was standing in the corner when Julie saw it. We had to get that put in the show, too. Okay, so this piece here, it got all the shredded 20s on it, you know, but this professor I had at the University of California in Clay, one time he gave me this bag, and I still got some of it in the studio someplace. You know, the shredded $20 bills, and they cut them up, you know, instead of just burn it. But anyway, I wind up with a whole bunch of it. So I set this guy up, you know, and there was an exhibit that happened in San Francisco, and they were inviting people that weren't mask makers. And so I took some time thinking, how can I make something that has some impact for this? And they had this famous Navajo guy, too, that's in all the airports in the world, you know, and I thought, you know, well, he and the other guys were doing that, too, so I thought, I got to do something. And so I finally come up with this piece, and I called it at that time Icon 86. It must have been 86 when it was done. But anyway, when it made it to the show, and then someone sent me the clipping in the newspaper that this piece was standing in the middle, and it said it set the tone for the show. And so that was nice. And it just kind of, and it was a wolf that I had used. I had an Arctic wolf, and I made wolf blinds that run all the way up through about halfway up. And that's what I had in the show. So I loaned it to a guy. No, I didn't loan it. I put it in a gallery down by San Juan Batista. And I had it there. And then he says, I'm going to take it to a powwow. And he took the hide off. And then he came back. He said, I can't give it to you now because it's blessed. He said, but I'll give you another wolf. And so it's a whole wolf. So he became the corporate wolf after that. Okay, here's another piece that's pretty sensitive. You know, talked about. You know, back in 79 when we lost that little boy, that his name was Tom, and I painted two paintings at that time. The other one I had in the I was an artist in residence here, and I had it in the faculty show, and it was pretty ugly, but it was really ugly. You know, one day in Hoopla, I came back from the city, and we heard there was a shooting in Orleans, and there was a guy down. Well, what it was a 16-year-old boy walking across some property right by the highway in Orleans, and this paranoid guy was sitting on processed marijuana, and he thought the kid was, you know, trying to do something, and he shot him with a bursting machine gun burst, and the guy never served any time. He was acquitted, and I just wrote that kid. And then what bothered me is that I knew this guy's dad. I was setting chokers with him before I went to school. You know, and he was telling me how that they had a baby and they wanted another one, and the wife just couldn't seem to get pregnant. And then so they decided to adopt. And then she got pregnant with this boy, and he called, he says, Payday, when he heard she was pregnant. And then he nicknamed him Daypay. And all his life, for 16 years, he was called Daypay. So I said, Daypay, dead at 16, a paranoid man painted with white paint, just dripping, you know, white man, you know, acquitted. And that's just, it went on a design piece. It lays right where I stack wood in the house, and I don't even have a frame on it. But, it was somehow I needed to say something about it, you know, it just, because I knew all the details and the sad part of the thing. That's why I say it's ugly. Anyway, so this one here, I started them the same time. But this one here was finished in a short time. In 30 days, I finished this one, and the boy lasted 30 days. He died, and we buried him on New Year's Day. And it just didn't work. I had all this blue, deep blues, and different blues, and all of a sudden I went through with just a baby blue. And I call that the touch of baby blue, and it just worked. And it was juried into an exhibition in the Wheelwright Gallery in New Mexico. And it's just right off the way in Santa Fe. And what's happening, 1978, contemporary Indian art. And some people even said, I don't know why that got in there, you know, because it's really contemporary stuff. But anyway, my family and us, we all went down there, and it was like healing in it for us. Then I almost lost it. I left it with some gallery people down, and the gallery changed, and then the gallery next people didn't want to send it back. And I just happened to know the people in Washington, D.C. that gave me nominated me for the Heritage Award, and she wrote some nasty letters down there to the state capitol people. Boy, and they got on them, and they sent that stuff back, costing about $300 to get all that stuff back. As they arrived, packed it all up, you know, but I got it back. And so this was my daughter and my son. They both wanted it, you know, and I finally gave it to my son back there, who named his boy Tom. Tom Gabriel. So anyway, that's the end of the stuff here, guys. And thank you, everybody, for coming tonight.